Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Now, we've talked a great deal about cancer on Friday Night Clive and the many different types, and we've also talked to a lot of people about how they're coping with the disease and the treatments that they're going through, and of course those treatments are wide and varied. What we haven't done until now is talk about cancer with someone we know, and this makes it immensely more personal. Tonight I'm going to talk to my Black Country Radio colleague Ken Francis, and you'll know Ken, I'm sure, and you'll know him when you hear his voice and that cheeky laugh. Now, Ken has been experiencing esophageal cancer over the last probably couple of years ago, and he's agreed to come and tell me his story and how he's getting on with his treatment. And you can hear from the giggles in the background. I'll give him his mic. He's here now. Hello.
I don't change, do I?
No, you don't. No. But please do not change. Please do not change. Ken, lovely to see you. Thank you for coming in. We all know what cancer is,
yes,
largely, but what is esophageal cancer?
Well, your esophagus is basically, these things I've learned, it's the tube that runs basically from your throat to your stomach. Mm. And then in between your stomach and the esophagus, you've got the lez, which is the lower esophageal sphincter, which basically opens and closes and drops your food and drink into your stomach. And I was diagnosed with esophageal cancer in October 2020.
So it was nearly 2 years ago.
Yes,
wasn't it?
That's
right. Yeah. And that thing, so when some people say I have a hiatus hernia. So is it that part that's not operating properly, so the contents of your stomach can come back up?
It's, in my case, they think it was. It wasn't, the sphincter wasn't operating properly. You eat, it opens basically, stuff drops into your stomach, and only through talking to my surgeon, he said when he got in there, he actually realised that what had happened was that a little bit of acid had kicked up, and after a while it had caused a tumour and cancer.
Now, I'll let you into a secret. I have something similar. I have damage to my esophagus through, yep, acid reflux, and so I take tablets to stop that from happening. Mm-hmm. But they put a camera down me where I live, my health trust does it every 5 years.
Yeah.
And they check, because there is damage, but they check the cells don't mutate onto something else.
That's it.
And that's where the problems start. Now, I guess with you, that mutation had taken place.
It had. I mean, it started when we was all in lockdown. And we sort of went lockdown is about March the 20th, didn't we, in 2020. Mm. And it was about the May time I started having acid reflux, or what we thought was acid reflux, should we say. And of course, you can't see a doctor. Everything was over the phone. And it was, they put it down to stress. I mean, my business had stopped. We're all in lockdown. Life had changed completely. Mm. Nobody knew when it was going to open again, and they put it down to that. And time went on, and it was a point where you couldn't eat, and you'd eat something, and you're trying to get this basically reflux to stop happening because you couldn't get food inside you.
No.
And then it would clear, and then you carry on. This is acid reflux, and I've been reassured by other people who had it, members of the family. We've had that. We take omeprazole, and we're fine. Twice I went to A&E in the evening, and it had started, and it had started this where reflux of when you've got food inside you. And when you go into A&E, there's like community care and actually A&E, and I was put into community care, and they examined me, and they said, I mean, quite rightly, we had all the symptoms of acid reflux. And they said, you're just having a very bad case of acid reflux, which you accept. And it went on. And then come October, we went down to the caravan. I said, because we were sort of let loose a bit then, weren't we? The lockdown had been taken off us. So we thought, we'll go to the caravan. I'll do dinner at the caravan. Be nice. It's only over at Bewdley. Chill out. I cooked dinner. I ate two chips and it started. This is on the Sunday. And it started and I couldn't stop. I stood out in the field. I just couldn't clear it. Mrs. Ken drove me home because we couldn't do anything. We just, the day had stopped. That week, I couldn't eat. I couldn't get any fluids, yes, but I couldn't eat. And on the Saturday, we decided to try some Weetabix. Just a little bit of half a Weetabix, bit of milk, soft. I had that. Within 2 or 3 minutes, the reflux has started again. And it starts and it just can't stop it. It's just constant. It's hard to explain.
Is it, when you've eaten your food or you try and eat, do you get what I call the hickey burps, which is a hybrid of hiccups and burps?
It's not so much a hickey burp. It's more like just a very large hiccup It just keeps going.
So your body's rejecting.
It's not a hiccup. It's really a real shakes your body. Mrs. Ken went out. She came back a few hours later and found me upstairs with my head against the door, gripping my chest. And we said, A&E again. We've got to go now. And I said, I can't go in because at the time you could only have one person go into A&E. You couldn't take somebody with you. And I said, you've got to come with me. I just couldn't fill the form out. And we went in and she was explaining about my symptoms, and the receptionist was watching me. And she's saying, I think he's got to go A&E. I think he's having a heart attack. It was that bad. And I was in absolute agony right across my chest. I was holding my chest, like with my hands under my armpits, gripping my chest with the pain. And I went in and they examined me and they did all the bits and pieces. Said, you're not having a heart attack. We think you've got a very bad case of acid reflux. So you have to accept it once again. But we're going to keep you in overnight. Brilliant, I thought. Absolutely brilliant. So I stayed in overnight. First doctor come round, starts talking to me, going through the symptoms. Everything said acid reflux. Yeah, so I'm not arguing with anybody in the medical profession, but everything just said it, acid reflux. And he said, you know, we don't treat acid reflux, you'll be going. And I said, do you know I haven't been able to eat all week? I can't even get half a Weetabix inside me. And he just stopped. And he was with another doctor, and the two of them looked at each other. And he said, you're going nowhere, you're staying here. And then from that point on, I had people come in from the oncology ward. I'm learning all these words, oncology ward, and examine me. And 2 days later, they gave me a CT scan, followed by an endoscope. Mm. Which is basically an endoscope, if you don't know what it is, basically a camera down your throat to find out what's not the most comfortable things to do, but you can do it, actually. It is feasible. And then they told me, when they took the camera out, I saw the doctor was doing the procedure, just sitting in the corner, and he just put his face into his hands and then wiped his hands down his face. And I just looked at him and said, it's cancer, isn't it? He said, yeah, I think it is. But we're going to have to test some samples. And your mind just explodes. Absolutely explodes. There's a nurse with me. She was brilliant. She was saying, you know, it's just been discovered. It may not be, but there's many things. And she reeled off all the things.
And that's true. There is.
There is. But when you've just been told, that don't count.
as humans, go down the worst case scenario,
exactly.
don't we?
That doesn't count. So that was taken up to the ward. And by chance, I could eat. And my dinner was there, so I ate it.
So you ate a normal dinner?
I ate a normal dinner. Right. I was hungry, irony, yeah. So I just ate and ate and ate. And then I had to tell Mrs. Ken, and then she came over and we talked about it. I had to stay a night for another night in the hospital. And the next day, we had a meeting about it. And Mrs. Ken brought in daughter number one and a wife who were both medically trained. Mm-hmm. So I just let the women folk talk. I mean, to be honest, I was in the daze. They're actually talking about somebody else, not me here. You do get into that sort of phase. And the doctor sat there, and he was very good. We had a Macmillan nurse in with us, and the doctor sat there. We were very quiet. And he said, I think I could do something about this. It's a very simple operation, but it's a massive one. And I remember those words, and the ball started rolling from there.
But, I mean, there are different types of esophageal cancer, aren't there? What did you learn about the properties of yours?
I don't know the properties of mine. I must admit, I don't know if it's because I've blanked it off, I've cut my hands over my eyes. I never went into what type of cancer it was. I wasn't interested. Cancer, to me, is cancer. Mm. You can call it all the different names, the different types and all that. As far as I answered, it was cancer. And far as I from the time they found it, I had, in my opinion, but nobody had said this to me, I had 2 weeks to live. And we discharged me from hospital. They said, we'll be in touch with this, that and the other. And I basically went home and put all my life into order. Letters to people, kids, and make sure all the finances in the right place, passwords, they can get into stuff, where everything was, who the solicitor was. And I mean, it was that deep. And 2 weeks later, I realised I was still here. And it sounds crazy, and I may laugh about it. But at the time, I seriously thought.
Well, you know, the bottom drops out of your world, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Really, literally. Then you also think not only of yourself, but Mrs. Ken and the girls as well.
Yeah, you do. You think, you know, what you're leaving, you won't be here. I mean, that's my theory, and I know it sounds very harsh, but it's what you're leaving.
Mm.
And that's the bit that hurt me more than anything else, you know, upsetting everyone.
But that's not your fault.
No, it's not. But it's still the feeling you get.
Yes.
And there's no way you can work around that one at all.
And regretfully, it's nothing you can control either.
Well, that is something. You see, I'm very strong-willed mentally. I mean, you know me for quite a while. Hmm. But you know, no matter how strong-willed mentally you are not in charge of this.
No, you're not.
You know, you are not in charge in any way or form.
Hmm.
And the worst part for me, I mean, I'm in a job, I'm a photographer. When you've got products or something to do, everything starts now. So somebody may ring up at 7 o'clock and say, I need this something doing. It's now. And I had to wait to get into the system to get things happening. May have only been a week, but that was, you know, 6 months to me. You know,
so what happened next then?
What happened next? I had to go into hospital. We had to talk about what they feel they could do. We spoke about many things. A lot of it is a blur, and please don't think I'm trying to push it to one side, because when you're in this world, things happen around you and you don't actually take everything in. It's best to take one or two people with you who will see it from the outside in. When you're actually living it, you don't always absorb. From there, you had to jump through hoops to see whether what they could do. I'm at Russell Hall Hospital, I just can't thank enough. I was sent over to QE for the surgical side.
So how do you know how they actually carried out the surgery? I mean, clearly you're under anaesthetic, but what's your understanding of the procedure that they did?
Well, the procedures, you have to go through certain procedures to get that far.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, I had to have a PET scan. A PET scan is a complete scan from the top of your head to your tip of your toes,
mm-hmm.
And it's down to half a centimetre, and they're looking for anything in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through that, and you got through that hoop. They said, no, believe it or not, it's just a 2-inch tumour, and it's in one place. Gives you hope. It's not in your lymph nodes, it's not in your lungs, it's not in the bones. I remember the nurse saying it to me. She said, because I said, oh, it's in my throat. No, it's not in your throat. We've checked there, it's not there. And you have these ideas, it's everywhere. Your arm aches, oh, it's now in my arm. And no matter what people tell you, you know best, because, you know, but your arm may ache due to the fact that you were leaning on it. You know, these little things. Then you had to go through, talk to the surgeon, and the surgeon says, yeah, great, but we'll have to do a swab in your stomach. So you have to go for a little operation to see if there's any microbes in your stomach. And I got through that hoop. And he come out and he said, do you know what? It's just in one place. So they put me on chemotherapy for over Christmas 2020. And it's about 8 weeks of chemotherapy. I was on that flock. And it just felt Christmas dinner was still in restrictions. And it just felt like your last Christmas dinner with the family. It was a very surreal thing just sitting there after making dinner. I wasn't allowed to. I mean, you think of COVID, people weren't allowed to have contact. I was in a double bubble because I wasn't allowed to take the shopping out the basket. You know, they brought the shopping home. I wasn't allowed to take it because it had to all to be wiped down. One of my daughters who lives with us still had to walk around with a mask on, and she virtually lived in the conservatory to keep away from me. I wasn't allowed to pick up letters, and they said just keep away from anything that can get an illness.
And it's worth pointing out here that when you have chemotherapy, part of the way in which it works, it debilitates the white cells. It burns the cancer, but it debilitates the white cells, which boost your immune system. So really, you could have picked up anything just by somebody crossing the same threshold.
And they were so strict indoors. I mean, you yourself, you've become a little lapsidaisical. Oh, come on, you know. They were so strict indoors. I was just held into one place. We got through it. We got through into the January, and they gave me another scan. They said, believe it or not, it's really shrunk your tumour.
Mm-hmm.
You're now down for surgery. And
so they had to get the size down first before.
Well, it was to make sure there was a reaction to shrink it, to make sure that I hate to use the terminology, you can actually qualify for surgery.
Yeah, but I know what you mean.
You know, there is a way of looking at it that there's no good just saying, right, we're going to put you in surgery, and realising that actually it's somewhere else in the body as well. It's not going to work that way.
Mm.
But I needed an ICU bed. An ICU bed in the middle of a pandemic.
They're rarer than hen's teeth at the best of times.
It's unbelievable. And you sat there, and you have 10 weeks from the end of your chemotherapy to when you have to start chemotherapy again. And in that 10 weeks, and I was talking to my surgeon said, I'm now ringing Stoke, Gloucester, I'm ringing any hospital who can do this surgery. You're at the top of the list for surgery. And he came up after about seven weeks and he said, look, I won't be able to do your surgery. I'm having to pass you over to another surgeon. Mm-hmm. And you've got so much faith in this one surgeon. And I'd said, and disgusting of me, I said, well, how good is he? You know, and he said, oh, he's good. He said, same outcome, different method.
Mm.
And I met him, and this guy, his name is Mr. Tan, he just put so much, I don't know, he made you feel so much at home, so much at ease from the moment he met you. I mean, literally, I mean, I used to call him Mr. Happy Eyes, because all I could see was his eyes, because he had a mask on all the time. And it was everything, yeah, don't worry about that, we'll get it sorted, that'll be a problem. So we hung on, and then suddenly they said, you're in next Wednesday, coming at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you're going in for surgery. And it was as simple as that. The surgery was a 7.5-hour operation. I found out afterwards it's the second biggest operation you can actually have.
Right.
I know, I was taken back by
that. If you're comfortable, can you talk me through what you know of what they did?
Yes, yes, of course, there's no problem at all. I mean, I'm not going to take my top off. I am scarred.
No, please don't. It doesn't work on radio.
This radio. I am scarred, and I haven't got a problem with it. It's basically they go in through the stomach, go in, do keyhole surgery through your stomach, and then they turn you on the side, they cut you open basically from your shoulder blade right the way around under your arm to just to the side of your body. They then break two ribs, they go in, they then collapse a lung, they then go further in, and then they cut out the cancerous tumour. And then they cut the part of the stomach out, so I've lost part of my stomach. I think it's about a third to a half of the stomach. And then they pull it all up. I mean, this just sounds very, very casual. They pull it all up and sew it all back together in. So your esophagus is still attached.
And that's
to your
clearly
stomach.
Why they needed to shrink the cancer to start with.
I think so, yeah, to make sure that they could get in and do it. And then you do nothing about this. I mean, you know, I was going in for the surgery, and I've got all these people sitting around me, and you're thinking, oh. They said you got a 97% chance of success, a 2% chance of never, ever leaving the hospital, and 1% chance of not making it off the table. What figure do you see out of those three?
Oh, you see the positive. I'd see the positive.
I see the 3%.
Right.
Anybody in my position will just see that 3%. And they take you in. I'm going in, and I said, I feel really nervous. And they all said, oh, wouldn't it's a day job to us. We're doing this all the time. Mm. And that's the way I like it. It's the casualness of, yeah, no, you're going to be fine. I wake up. There's more tubes.
What did you first think of? When you woke up, what went through your mind?
I don't know. It's just a daze.
Did you think, I'm still here?
I think that was it. Some of it was that it. You know, was it been 5 minutes, 10 minutes? You know, and it was a bit of a case of what's going on. And because they couldn't put me into an ICU ward, they had to put me in something called I think it's called a PACU ward. Basically, it was a ward where all the beds were far apart as they could, but they had a plastic sheet between them. So you was living in this thing. You had 24-hour nurse with you the whole time. And I was in there for 4 days. And I can remember some of it, but I can't remember all of it.
Mm.
Because you're in and out, and you've got a stent in your back for pain. Mm. You've got a thing in your hand that you can give yourself morphine. And then after 4 days, they said it would take you up to the ward. Now, I didn't want to leave PACU because I was being looked after. Now, this is rather foolish of me, but this is the way your mind works. I thought, if I go up to a ward, I'm just going to be a number on the ward. And I'll start to worry. When you get to the ward, you realise you're not a number. They have got you really covered. They're watching you. People are watching, observing you more than you realise. And after a day, you felt really reassured, you know, the way things were going on. I had a feed in my left-hand side that went straight into my lower intestine to feed me. And that was it for 3 days, two days. And then they said, do you want some mashed potato? He's like, oh. Because you have to learn to swallow again.
Right.
Your whole body, without being crude from what goes into what comes out, has had a bit of a shake-up.
Okay, that makes sense.
And you really have to learn how to swallow again, how to take stuff in. And they let me have some water and then mashed potato. Which was like mashed potato and gravy. It was absolutely wonderful.
A feast.
A feast. It was absolutely brilliant. And, you know, the surgeon used to come in and have a chat with you and talk on the ward. And I'd say, could you ring Mrs. Ken, you know, tell her what's going on? Not knowing that they were always talking to her. But they'd never said no. Yeah, give us a phone. I phone now. Hey, you go, yeah, it's fine. Everything's wonderful. Yeah, and all that. I did have one little mishap where about a day after I had my surgery, I had an infection. And I was hallucinating, and I actually thought I was dying, and I was telling people, I'm dying, aren't I? I'm dying. You know, my poor kids, I'm dying. And I kept seeing cartoon animals coming out from behind people. Mm-hmm. You were completely tripping, with all due respect. So mm-hmm. I could see, you know, cartoon, I don't know, purple elephants and green tigers, and you just kept looking, and you could just look around the room at these things coming out. And then you shut your eyes, and they're gone. But you just see a sea of red, and then the red goes like bubbles, and it's in front of you. So get rid of that. You open your eyes again.
So was that the infection doing
yeah,
that?
Yeah, the infection. Right. My temperature had shot right up, and I'd got an infection. But they were on top of it. They, you know, they put in some penicillin or whatever they put in, and they brought it down. And I was up on the ward. And there is no way you can rest in hospital. The things going on the whole time. But people were coming, they were taking me blood pressure, they were doing this, they were doing that, and it's constantly on the go. They said you'll be in 14 to 16 days. And he said, I don't know if it was a joke, if you're out in 9 days, you're an athlete. Day 7, he said, do you want to go home tomorrow? I know, this massive operation. I said, not half. And then, but you have to go through physio, you're trying to reinflate your lung because that's been taken away from you. Nobody's allowed to visit. And all this time, you've got to remember, we're still in COVID and I wasn't allowed any visitors.
No.
So I was dealing with this, I would never say alone because somebody were coming up, brilliant Macmillan nurses coming up to talk to me, to get me out of bed and put me in a chair because I'd become sort of, I won't say bedbound, but you're safe in your bed.
I know, but it's not good for you to be in your bed all the time, though, is it?
But they have this thing, you think, oh, I'm all right, I won't move, I'll be okay. So they get me out of bed and try to move me around. And physio had to basically get me walking again. And I had to walk, and I was holding this thing on wheels, which was basically with me feed. And then I had to go up and down stairs.
And how long did that process take?
That was over about 2 to 3 days. You know,
oh, quite quick then.
Yeah, 2 to 3 days. They really, there's no good sitting around you. They've got to get you up and get you going. And that's what they did. And they got me going. And then they basically, they said, well, going out tomorrow. Well, to get out, I mean, you're just sitting there thinking, oh, I'm going home in a minute. I'm going home in a minute. And I think I got out about 8 o'clock at night. And by the time they made me a walking stick, because I'd have a special walking stick because I'm so tall, and then they had to give me so much feed, and then you had to learn to feed yourself through this thing into your stomach with this machine and how to work it all. And then there's all these drugs. This has to go at 6, you have to have this one at 7, this one has to go at 8:30. Then you have to have injections in your stomach for... And it just rolls on, all these things to do. And they wheel me out with all this bag and stuff, and they put me in the car, and I felt every pebble on the road on the way home. I was in a terrible state when I got home. Got home, I couldn't sit down, I couldn't stand up. I didn't know what to do myself. No. And
so what did you do?
I moaned a lot, I think. I think it's the only way. I mean, I wasn't the most happiest person about it all, but you knew that you had just to get on with it. I mean, I'm that sort of character. My daughter, she'd got all the drugs, and she started doing a list and wrote it and put it on the fridge so they knew what drug had to go in when and where and all that. And I left them to deal with that. You know, I'm not in a position to do it. I had to have a feed overnight, which was probably, I think, one of the most annoying things, because you've got this... Now, you know it's doing you good. Do not get me wrong, and I am not ungrateful. But after about 2 weeks of it, it was driving you mad. And I couldn't lie down, and I was given morphine, and the morphine was for the pain. And the only pain I was getting was in my back, because I couldn't lie down. I couldn't stretch my body out. I couldn't do it. And I used to take the morphine purely for my back pain. And after a while, we came off the feed, but this tube was still in my stomach. I've got a Hickman line in my chest. which is basically they can administer drugs straight into your arteries, straight directly at you. There's no messing around. It goes straight in. And, you know, you had to go every week to Briley Hill to have it flushed out and looked after. Brilliant nurses at Briley Hill looking after you the whole time. Everybody was on the phone. If we had a problem, we could phone anybody and we would get somebody on that phone and help us out. Mm. Cannot fault the system in any way whatsoever. After about, this is in the March the 17th, I went in. And by May, I was eating fairly well. I was off the feed, but the line was still in. I had so many mashed potato and rice pudding and ice cream. Sounds wonderful. But you think, oh, I could just do with a... And you think of something you could just do with.
A roast or something.
Yeah. And you go through that system and then you go back into chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And the chemotherapy... Chemotherapy is... Everybody's journey in chemotherapy is totally different. So to say, well, this is what happens, is totally incorrect. Mm. Everybody will find it a different way of doing it. And I went through chemotherapy in May, June and into July. And... it's a build you up steroids for about 4 days, and in those 4 days you have the chemotherapy, and then they stop the steroids. And that is the hardest part for me, because I'm massive depression for about 5 days afterwards. Because you come off that and you come...
Slap back down.
And you're down and you're thinking... And I actually said, look, just let it take me. I just can't deal with this no more. And the worst thing was they didn't tell me when I had the first lot of chemotherapy in the December, was that you had to self-inject and put white blood cells back into your body after so many days. And I just looked, I said, that is not going to happen. That is no way this is going to happen. Fortunately, people, you know, daughter number one, she's medically trained, came in, started doing it, taught Mrs. Ken how to do it, and she used to do it, and she used to basically, it was like a commando style, creeping up behind me at 6 o'clock at night, saying, sit there, belly out, boff, in. And that was the one that really broke me, was having the injections. Mm. But she administered over 60 odd into me over a period of time, and it was over a few months. And you then start to recover, and you're thinking, have they got it out? Did it work? Am I actually going to go to have some kind of stable life again? Am I going to eat properly? Am I going to be able to leave the house? Because I come very... not housebound was the wrong thing to say. I didn't want to leave because I was in my little safety barrier.
It's a question of confidence, isn't it? You've lost a lot of confidence.
You have, because you want to know where the drink is. You want to know where the toilet is. Because you don't know how life's going to go.
Right. So how much time elapsed to the point when your surgeon had you back and you'd had your chemotherapy and everything?
Yeah.
And your surgeon said... You're all right. It's clear now.
After he sent me home and he said, you'll be hearing from me in about... And he sent me home, I don't know, mid-20s of the March. Mm-hmm. And he said, you'll be back in about three, four weeks to see me and see how you're getting on. Mm-hmm. And in that 3 weeks, I actually walked from the car up to his room in the QE. And... when he cut it out, he actually said, you know, when I cut it out, he said, some people cut out, you know, round it. He said, I've cut round, basically, if you don't need it, it's gone, he said, in the area. He said, I've taken it out. It's no point just messing around.
No.
And he said, when I got in, he said, I could see it was dead. I could also knew what was causing it. And I said, what is it? Is it, you know, what is it? Because smoking and drinking are the two big things that can cause it. And he said, in your case... bad luck. And how do you work? It's just bad luck. And he said, we've had the tests and it's dead. There's nothing in the lymph nodes. So your mind goes to thinking, maybe I'll get through this. Not I will, and maybe I'll get through this. And I'm a photographer by profession. And I had bookings on mid-July. And I'd written to people and I said, this is what's happened. If you want to cancel me, fair game. I'm going to, you know, I understand fully. And nobody said, oh, it's a few months away. We'll see how it goes. One bride, Nikki, I mean, can't thank enough. She said, if you can't do it on the morning of my wedding, I'll find a photographer. I want you to do it. So it became a target the 18th of July. And my great friend Steve from Merlin Videos, he came out and backed me up. So I wasn't totally on my own in dealing with it. Mrs. Ken came out, she helps out because I can't lean forward anymore, because you lean forward not having the sphincter, everything rolls down into your thing. We got through that. We got through one afterwards. Jane Jordan in Stourbridge, she came out and gave me a hand. Everybody pulled together to help me out. And then I started shooting on my own. Not many bits and pieces, but it's what I needed to get out. Come September, I decided that I've been a bit of a fool, really, because I was shattered. And I only had two or three other little jobs. And I said, I'm going to see these out. And in November, I'm stopping. That's it. I'm not looking for work. I'm not doing anything. I have got to stop. And we'd spoken to the surgeon. We got special insurance. And in the September, actually, I went away for a week. I went off to Lanzarote. And you do not know how difficult it is. You think, oh, great, I'm all right now. I've been doing this. I've been doing that. I can walk a bit. I can, fantastic. Flew over. And the travelling absolutely exhausted me for 2 days. I mean, really? Completely wiped me out. When we leave our hotel, I mean, it's a hotel we've been going to for years. You know, if you go down, I don't know, 60 yards, over the crossing, down the seafront, nice stuff like that. I could make the first restaurant bar, which was 50 yards away. And that's where we stayed, basically, for food and that for 2 days. That's as far as I could walk, go back and sleep.
But at least you knew your limits. That's the thing. That's the key. And you
didn't, I knew my limits. I had a target. We had this target all the way through from start to finish, because I fought having injections to start with in the stomach, because it was just something I just couldn't, deal with. And I was also doing, also the thing I couldn't deal with in chemotherapy was the smell. I did not smell. But I smelt myself. And I was always washing underneath my armpits because I smelt, I could taste it, it was in my throat. When the injections went in for the white blood cells, I could feel it in my legs and I could feel it, I could taste it, or could I don't know, but that's the way I work with it. But we had this thing that we had a goal. And our goal was to get to the Aussie bar. It just sounds stupid. I know it sounds stupid, but you've got to set yourself a target, yes, set yourself a goal. And ours was the Aussie bar on Lanzarote seafront. And that's what the goal was. And it's about a mile from the hotel. I can't drink, but the bar was the target. Laid-back place on the seafront. I mean, I use the term nothing special. It is special because it's so laid-back. And we managed to get here in the first week. We managed to walk down there.
Very good.
Have a drink and walk back. And that, you felt great. But then, since then, I've been resting. And taking it easy. I can now eat virtually what I like. I eat a lot of salad because it works for me. I can eat a steak, even though I did. When you have it and they sort of cut your esophagus and then sew your stomach up, there's going to be a join.
Yes. Yeah.
And that join can sometimes have scarring tissue around it. And as my surgeon said, your food will sometimes stick there. And you have to regurgitate. You're not being sick, you regurgitate. And you can, and to start with, when I first started eating, they said, oh, you can go on to shepherd's pie now. Shepherd's pie for a mashed potato. Oh, it was wonderful. But there's so many shepherd's pies you can eat, of course. But then you want something else. And I became too adventurous, and I got food stuck, and you have to regurgitate. But you can go back to the table and eat again. It's not being sick.
No,
it's just clearing
the
blockage.
It's just clearing that blockage, which is key.
And now I can virtually eat what I like. 2 weeks ago, I did get something stuck, but I was in a restaurant. Yes, I was going out to restaurants now. That was a big leap, a very, very big leap. And I had a steak, and I cut a big piece too big, and I didn't chew it enough. But we've all done it. You think, oh, it's nice, isn't it? And you swallow it, and it goes down. Yeah. I don't have that. I've got to remember to cut them small, and you're told to be seated, small and slowly. And I didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I suffered from it. Suffer badly.
As you sit in front of me now, you look in rude good health. How are you really now?
I'm waiting a scan in 4 weeks' time. And I have had a lot. I put myself into counselling because it's great. I'm very great when I'm dealing with a situation. I'm brilliant. I can deal with it. So I didn't talk much about my cancer. My kids were actually going to Mrs. Kennan saying, well, how's he doing? You don't say much. You know, you don't talk about it, but that's the way I am about it all. But I've put myself into counselling because you hit what's called, in my theory, the anniversary, the time you were confirmed to have it. oh, I was just going into chemotherapy this time a year ago. I was sitting waiting for the operation this time of year. And it was these things, these yearly, these annual things. So I put myself into chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And I've been going to, excuse me, see a counsellor at the White House Cancer Support up in Dudley. Mm-hmm. And I would tell him my counsellor's name, but I never asked his permission. So I do apologise if you're sitting out there. And he has done me a power of good. Because it's getting over many issues. It's all right talking to somebody like yourself and talking to somebody who has never experienced it. But to talk to people who've been through it and done it, it's a different ballgame altogether. Mm. And it's changed my mind. It's made me more relaxed. And I can't thank the White House Cancer Support enough for what they're doing. But the Macmillan nurses are brilliant. The NHS is brilliant. I could just roll on. Yeah. About everybody who's been brilliant and behind me all the way through, especially my family.
Sure. Well that's where the support really starts, yeah. Isn't it? It's your family, to be fair. In a couple of minutes, can you explain to me the key thing that you've learned throughout this experience?
Where'd you start? You know, you if you got something wrong, I know we know Andy Gorham, the Rangers and Scottish international goalkeeper. Now, he's only 57. I'm just turned 60, and I know I don't look...
You don't look a day over 27, Ken.
Thank you. But Andy Gorham, I mean, all jokes apart, has just been confirmed with esophageal cancer. Mm-hmm. He's been given 6 months. And if you're suffering from acid reflux, in my opinion, do not accept it wholeheartedly. See if you can get further... medical advice looked into, and that way, that's how they found mine. Where Andy Gorham actually admitted, acid reflux, just a nuisance, and all this, that, and the other in lockdown. Mm. Ring a doctor, speak to him, off you go. And his one was found too late. I was very, very lucky from start to finish. Mm. And you know, it was, there's many things aspects you can talk about it all. Had you drunk too much alcohol? I don't smoke. But then the surgeon says, oh, it's bad luck. He says, because I've seen this before.
There's no point in trying to psychoanalyse what you haven't or haven't done. You're in the situation that you're in.
Yes.
And you can ask yourself as many questions as you like. You won't get an answer.
No, so you won't.
You just have to go, right, we're here where we are with it.
Yeah. And as I say, if you're suffering from acid reflux... I don't say you're going to be in the same situation with loads of people suffer from acid reflux. Even the members of the family go, oh, you've got acid reflux. We had that couple of tablets. We're back on our feet again. But that mine came from that, and it worked its way through. It's the same symptoms, as far as I can make out. I'm going to say I'm not medically trained, but from what I've been through, the same symptoms. My outlook on life is completely different. But through counselling, they ask one question after about 8 weeks. And the one question is something that, if you've not got the cancer or not been through it, what now? It's as simple as that. You know, you've gone through all this, what now? And you always fear, you know, like you've got a sore throat, it's in your throat. You know, you've got something wrong with your leg. Well, you just walked into a table 2 days ago, but that is, maybe something's come up there. They have told me at present... and this was last October, and my last scan, there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. You, Clive, have got as much chance of getting it as I have, and please don't think I'm
no, no, but you're right. One in two of us will get it.
Yeah. And we'll take it from there. And I've got a scan coming up in 3-4 weeks' time to find out if everything's okay. If that scan's clear, then I'm going to be discharged. And then you're on... No, you're not on your own, because they do look after you. Everybody's behind you. And then you're trying to work out, as you say, what next? What are we going to do now? Because it is a game changer. The way I sleep, I can't lay flat. I have to have a special pillow. I do sleep. I've been told I do sleep quite deeply. I eat virtually what I like. And I'm just trying to get on my life. It's as simple as that.
And also QED, quick early diagnosis, is key.
Exactly, that is it. I mean, to say with Andy Gorham, he let it roll, and it took over. And that is it. It's quick, early diagnosis. And I was down for an endoscope. Mm. But that was going to happen for 2 or 3 months because I was waiting for a list. It wasn't the fact that I actually went up to A&E and said, I'm in a horrendous amount of pain, that they took me in and they took it all from there. And it is a changer. I've spoken to other people who've been through it. I've read reports from other people who've been through it. It's a whole new life change from eating, drinking, planning your meals, small meals here, there and everywhere, when to stop eating so you can lie down at night. And it all rolls on from that point onwards.
Sure.
It's a game changer.
It's a remarkable story, and thank you for sharing it.
Thank
Ken
you for
Francis,
having me
thank you for talking to Friday Night Clive.
That is your lot for this episode. You can catch the programme live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you like our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcast or wherever you get your podcast from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast presented by Clive Payne and produced by Andy Caddick.